bio. Now, Claire, ridiculously modestly, told me that her bio was a bit flat on paper. So I think this is a typically maternal thing to say, to be self-effacing. So I padded it out again by hearing from a friend. Claire was actually my younger contemporary at Newnham, but we're still trying to place each other. We weren't in the same hall, you see. She read history in 1972 and then worked after graduation in London, temping in legal publishing. In 1976, she returned to Homerton and took her PGCE. But I'm told that she felt some pressure to be a secondary rather than a primary teacher, as she might have preferred. In 77, she taught history at Rickards Lodge High School for teenage girls. And after that, she married and became, though perhaps not as a result, PA to the director of the newly formed Heritage of London Trust. She moved to London with her husband, who was then a barrister and is now a judge in family matters. And again, not only self-effacingly, but husband-effacingly, Claire, you told me that we probably wouldn't be interested in your husband, but that perhaps it seemed relevant to your journey because of the balance of home and work. And we are actually, we're incredibly interested in how intelligent women balance being supportive and supported by husbands as well as children whilst shaping your own career. Your children were born, all four of them, between 1982 and 92, and during that decade, you took on some informal, in other words, untitled and unpaid tasks in the local community. In 1995, you trained further in specific learning difficulties at the Helen Arkell Dyslexia Centre in Frensham. And since then, you've been teaching one-to-one struggling learners in various schools, this time much younger children from the age of five in schools, but also at their own homes, both children with dyslexia and with other difficulties too. And you describe yourself as an educational garage mechanic. Very nice. In addition, Claire, you told us that you make many of your own teaching materials and games, and you sell these on a small scale. I was told by someone who knows you that actually you undertake a massive amount of community work at your local church, and you're a true Good Samaritan, but you were too modest to tell us that yourself. Over to you, Claire. Thank you.
I think that actually says most of what I was going to say. as we've heard this morning, each of us has our own individual ideals, priorities and journeys, and our journeys are all fascinatingly different. I see life as a weaving process. Some threads are very strong and run throughout the whole. For me, one of those is my unshakable belief in the importance of family life. Other threads may be part of the weave for a while and then set aside for all sorts of different reasons, often to be picked up much later and become woven in once again. I also believe that nothing is wasted. In my own life, some of the threads that appear to have been laid aside are now becoming very useful and important to me again. I'd like to start with a short story that some of you may know about starfish. A large number of starfish lay abandoned by high tide on a sunny beach, unable to return to the safety of the seawater. A child was picking them up one by one and returning them to the sea. Two grown-ups came past and said to him, "You will never make a difference. Look how many there are." His response was, "To the ones I throw back, I'll make a difference." One of the benefits, and there are some, of getting older, it's a bit like climbing a hill and surveying the landscape that you have come from below. You have a slightly better sense of perspective than when you're on the ground, wading through fords and struggling with brambles. Whatever metaphor one uses, real life is seldom a straight path from A to B, following precise maps and well-laid plans. I would be lying if I told you my life had followed a very clear blueprint. In fact, I think they say life is what happens while you're making other plans. It is easy at university to see things largely in terms of brains. For most people, gaining a place at Cambridge is a mixture of exhilarating and terrifying, and pitches one into a new life where brain work accounts for a great deal of the time and energy expended over 3 or 4 formative years. I read history here and loved it, being stretched and challenged and revelling in the luxury of learning. I'm not super bright, and I did have to work very hard, but my time at Newnham was very happy, giving me, among other things, lifelong friendships. In my Cambridge days, I am not sure that the term transferable skills was in everyday use. In fact, I'm sure it probably hadn't even been invented. But nowadays, especially if we have older children, we're all familiar with these and many other keywords in application forms for jobs and courses and so on. My daughter's just applying for her master's course at UCL and had to fill in umpteen very precise boxes with details of specific skills acquired at every single stage of her life so far. So, with these hindsight spectacles firmly in place, though I may not have been aware of them at the time, I now see some of the transferable skills I developed during my history degree. And these include, apologies to all you history undergraduates or graduates for whom this is so obvious, looking at a single event or issue from many angles, looking for hidden causes beyond the obvious and a multiplicity of causes, being prepared to change one's view with the emergence of new evidence, and walking in other people's shoes. I could go on and on, but skills such as these have stood me in great stead for the job I now do, which might seem a far cry from anything strictly historical. We cannot weigh a degree in the scales of its immediate utility alone. But it can be easy, I think, to forget that many formative years have taken place before university, too. I have always, for as long as I can remember, loved being with children. As the eldest of 4, you might imagine I would want to escape, but I have had a lifelong interest in the way children tick, and still to this day, that fascination is a strong factor in who I am. However, certainly in the 70s when I was here, I felt in some ways that this attitude was seen as quite unusual and probably not very brainy. It didn't always sit easily with my history degree. So when, after a year of trying other things and working in publishing in London, I decided on a PGCE, I was strongly advised by many different people that my degree would be best used by teaching at secondary level. Is this working? So I allowed myself to be persuaded and trained at Homerton, which was not yet part of the university as it now is, before, as Jane said, before teaching in a large comprehensive school in Wimbledon. I won't say I regret this decision, partly because I'm not a regretter, and also because it gave me some valuable experience and probably much needed toughening up. I taught a wide range of abilities and interests, and some parts of it were very rewarding. But looking back, I think I would have made a better teacher of primary age pupils. Can you hear me at the back? Okay. I now see that, I believe anyway, I think I see it as well, there is no such thing as wasting your degree if you are engaged in a worthwhile job that you love, using your intellect and abilities and constantly adapting to the needs of people. But in the early years after Cambridge and before I embarked on my current path, there were times when I found it a bit hard to align my apparent intellectual ability with my inherent interest and gifts for working with young children. I do actually think this has changed now, and many excellently qualified graduates are working with very young children in many fields. This feeling was pronounced when I had the first 2 of our 4 children. By the time I had 4, I think people realised that was a pretty valid full-time job, at least for a while. But I remember the implied or actual raised eyebrows that with a good degree I was choosing to be a mum at home. How strange, possibly what a waste. When it came to building our own family, I believed that it was really important I should be largely at home and available to be there for our 4 growing children. We had 3 rumbustious boys and a girl in that order. What I realise with the gift of hindsight again is that motherhood is not a time-defined occupation. I strongly believe that teenagers, while apparently pushing their parents away as far and as fast as they can, actually need their parents' time and attention critically, in unexpected ways and often at extremely inconvenient times. Parental availability is, I think, of immeasurable importance to the well-being of adolescent and even young adult children. I said availability, not, I don't believe in hovercraft parenting or helicopter parenting or whatever it's called, but I do think children of all ages do need parental availability, and that's quite a big thing to think about when you're working out which path you're going to try and take the bit in between. So I'm perhaps slightly fraudulent here on today's panel, because my mothering and working have been rather more sequential than simultaneous, although I still feel I'm doing it simultaneously even now. During my time at home before my next stage of working, I became aware of various other factors that have become strong threads in my weave. And one is the need to be a strong support to my husband, who has a very difficult and demanding task as a family judge. He is very strong himself, and I don't want him to sound needy in any way, but it is a very difficult job, and I think I could not have been a support to him if I was bound up with my own totally demanding career path. And another is, after the importance of family life, and Jill spoke so well about this at the beginning, I expect most of us here value our communities wherever we live. But if everyone is too busy to get involved, many aspects of our community lives would not function at all. So in a small way, I gradually became involved in a lot of different things in our local life that still occupy a lot of my time and energy, now woven around my work. So how and why did I change direction in my working life? There were several contributory factors in my decision to retrain as a different kind of teacher. Firstly, classroom experience in my comprehensive school had taught me about the children I was not reaching, especially those who had arrived in secondary school without the literacy skills they needed to thrive. In a class of mixed ability 13-year-olds, I realised I was teaching the middle group, but that I was probably failing both the very bright, because proper differentiation hadn't really found a place in training and practice in those days, and I was also failing those who had arrived in high school unable properly to read or to put a meaningful sentence on paper. I began to feel a sense of desperation that I could not give these pupils what they really needed, which was individual time and care. Then I had first-hand experience, as other people have mentioned, as a mum of a child with dyslexia. The middle one of our sons, who himself is now also a teacher, was diagnosed at about the age of 8 or 9. When many bright dyslexics actually emerge from the early security of being able to read by memory and careful attention to the pictures. These were tricky times to watch the effect on one's child of a comparatively minor difficulty. I know several people in this room have experience of learning difficulties within their family, and it can affect many aspects of family life and can seem a huge mountain to scale without help. So this provided the emotional element in a decision to change course in my teaching career. And in turn, my experience of his difficulties has been of immense value in helping the many parents I have cared for alongside their young with similar problems. I say cared for the parents because in my job I become very involved with families, and beside every child with a problem there is often a parent with a problem. Sometimes, dare I say it, the parent is the problem. Then there were the real-life demands of a big family, being the sandwich filler between growing children and ageing parents, all sorts of practical considerations of in-betweenness. So I retrained by studying for a diploma in SPLD, which stands for Specific Learning Difficulties, hence my garage mechanic analogy, because although this course is primarily aimed at dyslexic learners, in practice it involves working with a huge array of difficulties that prevent children from achieving their potential. Dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, dys almost anything comes my way. If it doesn't work, I try to help sort it out. I've been doing this work for 17 years, and I do design a lot of my own resources and share those as well. I work one-to-one, but not exclusively in the primary age group, usually, but not exclusively in the primary age group. So a typical day might find me with a struggling 5-year-old and later a challenged 14-year-old. And therefore, I have to change a lot of things about myself in one day, my persona, my presentation, my vocabulary, all sorts of things. The work is fascinating, varied, demanding, and constantly challenges me to think round corners to find the best way to help each pupil. And it almost always involves a large measure of building or rebuilding confidence. I hold no illustrious titles or job descriptions, but the rewards in my working life are huge. They occur unexpectedly and delight me more than any paycheck ever could. So you could say I'm now rescuing starfish. Every choice made, of course, has an effect on another part of one's life. At each junction is a road not taken. And other factors such as luck also come into the weave. I am very fortunate that I have not had to be the main breadwinner in our family. We are very lucky in so many ways. But one reality is that, for instance, we still have the 1970s kitchen we have had since moving into our house 32 years ago. The judiciary is not a sort of enormously paid job, and I don't earn very much, so many of my friends are on their second new kitchen in that space of time. That may seem a very frivolous example, but cloth cutting is still a reality to be thought about. Are two top salaries essential to one's lifestyle? How will the getting of those salaries affect family dynamics and happiness? These are very personal issues, I realise. And just to finish, a worrying modern word applied to many young people is driven. This often seems to be used as a term of praise, but I worry about who is doing the driving. If a person is very ambitious and keen to get to the top of her particular field of work for her own reasons, that is one thing, and I admire it. But if, by having a good degree, women feel compelled by the expectations of others, peers, partners, the watching world, to achieve things that feel increasingly burdensome and damaging to other equally valid and important aspects of their life's journey, my advice would be to listen to your heart at least as much as to your brain, because while we are fortunate enough to have good brains, they do not define us absolutely. Our degrees give us choices, confidence, and many ways of living richly valuable lives.